Put this in my folder.
Make much of a crap.
There you go.
All right, good afternoon. Call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Time is 1:05 p.m. on Friday, April 20th, 2012. Let the record reflect the following members of the Resources Committee are present. Representative Herron, Representative Gardner, Representative Dick, Representative Munoz, Representative Foster, Representative Peggy Wilson, and Co-Chair Seaton, myself, Co-Chair Feige. We've invited members of the Special Committee on Energy, and Representative Pruitt, if you'd introduce your members.
Thank you, Representative Feige. We got Representative Sadler, Representative Peterson, Representative Lynn, also have Co-Chair Representative Foster, and myself, Representative Pruitt.
Okay, thank you. In the audience, Representative Dugan, Representative Tammy Wilson, Senator Giesel are also present.
Mr. Chair, is Representative Tuck.
Representative Tuck's online. We've been joined by Representative Kawasaki. Purpose of our meeting today is to hear House Bill 3001, Oil and Gas Production Tax, by the Governor. Presenting will be the Department of Revenue Commissioner Brian Butcher and Deputy Commissioner Bruce Dangeman. Also from Revenue, in the audience, we'll have Dan Stickle online, Matt Fonder, Sherry Niehus, John Larson, Lenny Dees, and Tim Rayard. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record,
I asked members of the committee to wait till at least slide six before they before they ask questions. And Commissioner, just be advised, you will be treated better here.
Maybe. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me is our Deputy Commissioner, Bruce Tangeman. And we have approximately 20-page PowerPoint here for you today, Mr. Chairman. As we worked on HB 3001, these were the goals we focused on. We focused on a bill that would incentivize production on the North Slope, both within existing units as well as outside and new units. We focused on something that we thought would generate additional jobs and activity for the Alaska economy. We wanted to build on work that had already been done during the legislative session by current legislative committees. We wanted to maintain the existing structure of ACEs with slight modifications, and the reason for that is we've had major changes in tax structure over the last 5-6 years, and we were hoping to be able to make our adjustments to the structure minimally so as not to cause the 70 plus regulations that the department had to take on after the passage of ACEs. And then we'd like to maintain alignment of working interest owners by not tying incentives to individual companies. And that's kind of a reference to the situation that was being dealt with in SB 192, where some companies saw tax reduction, some companies saw tax increases from the bill. The key provisions, and we tried to keep the bill fairly simple in that we're just working off of five main provisions. The first is 30% gross revenue exclusion for calculating a base tax and a progressive tax for qualifying new North Slope fields. we'll be walking through the specifics on these and exactly what the gross revenue exclusion is here in a couple of slides, so you'll have a better understanding of what it is we're talking about. It's just kind of a one more calculation to the current pretty complicated ACES equation. The second piece is a 40% gross revenue exclusion for calculating the progressive tax for existing North Slope fields, currently producing fields, and this 40% exclusion would only reduce the progressive tax. The base tax would stay the same at 25%. Also, we would cap the maximum tax rate that we could tax from 75%, which it is under current ACES law, to 60%. and we would extend a 40% well lease expenditure credit to the North Slope. Currently, the North Slope has a 20% credit, with the rest of the state south of 68 degrees north latitude being at 40%. This would extend it to the entire North Slope. And the last piece, and the most insignificant piece, although our folks that work internally wouldn't agree with me probably, is that we would allow capital credits to be redeemed in the year they're earned. Currently, they're redeemed 50% 1 year, 50% the second year. In talking to companies, in particular, smaller companies that may have cash flow issues, they say that having to receive half of a credit 1 year and then half the following year makes it difficult for cash flow. Having them all in the same year would be more beneficial. It would also be easier for the department to administer, and it would show an increase in the first year after it passed, a decrease because we were moving the second year up to the first year in the second year, and then it would be revenue neutral in the out years. So it's a basic revenue neutral case, although there would be differences in the first 2 years. And how the governor put this together was a hybrid approach where he wanted to take different pieces from different proposals that had been discussed in the building to a place that would be material. And the gross revenue exclusion for the new fields, that piece was taken from what the Senate Finance Committee came up with during the regular session as a way to incentivize production. It's set up exactly as they set it up. The production tax cap of 60% was introduced by the Senate Resources Committee as a way to limit state take at high oil prices, and we agreed that there should be a lower cap on taxes than where it currently is at 75%. And then we took the gross revenue exclusion structure that the Senate had used for new fields and applied it to existing fields to a level that we thought would be a material difference, meaning a level similar to the governor's HB 110, not as deep of a cut in taxes, but fairly close, to a point where we thought most of the companies that had testified they saw HB 110 as material and would mean billions of dollars of more investment would also likely view this bill that way, although we haven't had an opportunity to talk to the companies about it. We did hear yesterday afternoon from AOGA, and they said their first blush view of the bill is they still see this as meaningful tax reform that would change the way companies look at and invest in Alaska. And then the last piece, the well lease expenditure credit, came from House Bill 280 in 2010, which was a governor's bill that would have given a 40% credit to the entire state. The bill was changed throughout the process and only applies south of 68 degrees, and the governor would look to increase that well lease credit for existing fields to help the economics of getting more oil out of the ground in fields that are currently being produced.
For the record, Commissioner, just members of the committee, I know we're at slide 4. We've accomplished quite a bit already. Any questions? Representative Herron.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, just to those last two slides, both key provisions and hybrid, page. Could you just give us the thumbnail reasoning for 30% gross, 40% gross? I mean, it could have been 38, it could have been 42, et cetera.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, yes, it could. And the 30% for the new fields was put together by the Senate Finance Committee. When we ran the numbers, we saw them as very similar to how we had addressed new fields in HB 110. And so we kept that same language. In terms of the 40%, we looked at where we thought it would be meaningful. We looked at 35, we looked at 45, and 40% is where we came up with. Not as much of a reduction as HB 110, within a couple hundred million, but a little bit higher on that, which we still saw as being meaningful. And I guess, thanks for the question, Representative. It reminds me that the governor sees this bill as a hybrid bill that brings together a number of different concepts, but it's also kind of a way to start the discussion by pointing out that we can get to a meaningful place a number of different ways.
words.
HB 110 did it by putting in brackets, so progressivity wasn't as aggressive. This does it by dealing with the gross revenue exclusion that Deputy Commissioner Tangeman will explain when we get to the worksheet. You could also do it by making the progressivity curve more gradual. Instead of 0.4 and 0.1, you could make it 0.2, 0.05. That would have an effect. You could move the trigger dollar amount that progressivity kicks in to a higher number, so it's not quite so aggressive. You could play with the base tax rate of 25%. You could make it 22. You can make it 20. So there's a number of different ways that you can work at getting to what is a meaningful material change. And this bill primarily was to show that this, we believe, is one of them. Could it be changed? Could we do it a different way? Absolutely we could. And if the committee's interested in trying to get there a different way, then that's certainly something we'll be happy to work with you on. But this is kind of how we've moved forward on what we see as a hybrid approach.
Thank you.
President Barr?
Thank you. I just want to confirm my understanding on this slide. The key provisions of 30% gross revenue exclusion on new oil fields is only for 10 years. The 40% gross revenue for existing North Slope fields that you're proposing here is forever, and the new fields, when the 10-year period has passed, would roll over into this other term.
Through the chair, Senator Garber, you're correct.
Representative. That's twice today.
Don't make the same mistake as the other body.
Yeah, long morning for us and Senator Reese. Through the chair, Representative Gardner. That is absolutely correct, and also if I could point out that the 30% would reduce the base tax and the progressive tax for new fields, whereas the 40% would just be off the progressive tax.
Okay, and if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, actually not follow, but it's a different, slightly different question. The Senate has asked you for a whole bunch of different charts and data and answers to specific questions. And when those are available, would you also provide them to the members of these committees, including the ones there were some things you were going to try to get answers to today? Thank you.
The Chair, Representative Gardner, would be happy to.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Seed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your, I guess, slide two, the last bullet point, would you explain that again?
To maintain alignment, through the chair, Representative Seaton, to maintain alignment of working interest owners by not tying incentives to individual companies, which we were trying to take an approach that wouldn't result in tax increases to some companies and tax decreases to other companies.
Follow?
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if we're trying to incentivize companies to reinvest, and we're saying there's no difference in your tax break if you reinvest in Alaska or not. Does that kind of defeat the purpose of trying to make sure that we incentivize production?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think incentivizing production would be something we'd be certainly amenable to work on. What we didn't want to do was to have the changes made to the point where it could affect some companies detrimentally. And what happened was with the Senate bill was there was testimony that it was an actual tax increase at current prices and that they would have to reevaluate even what they thought was their current spending. And we wanted to make sure we laid out a structure that didn't result upon passage of a tax increase occurring.
One more follow-up.
Thank you. And I guess, first of all, just I would hope you'd reinvestigate that a little further because the implication is that everybody gets a tax increase whether you reinvest in Alaska or not if we're just passing that. So, but I guess the other thing that I had was the well lease expenditures on the next one, on page 3, on the definition of that. Well, lease expenditures, are those going to also include capital expenditures?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, it would. It would replace the current 20% that's on the North Slope with a 40%.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I guess when we get more deeply into it, I don't see it. When I read the bill, it doesn't replace it. It's additional to. So I think that I'm putting that question for you now so that you can come to it and make sure that that's not written as stackable, because that's the way I read the bill as it's written. So,
Mr. Chairman, we'll flesh that out.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Kelsock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ryan, for being here. The key provisions, I mean, the way I see 3001 looking is there's a handful, hodgepodge of provisions that were in the original House Bill 110, passed the House, was dead on arrival in the Senate. Senate Bill 192, which was their own creation, couldn't even pass the Senate. So you've taken what looks like a lot of provisions from both bills, slammed them into one big bill, and now are presenting it to this committee. And as we go through the provisions, I'd like to hear how each of the provisions get us to our key goals, and that's incentivizing new production, filling a pipeline, getting more capital developed here in the state. Because the way I see this bill, it's just a large bill with a lot of key issues that are difficult for us to swallow right now. So when you get a chance, can you go through each of those provisions? Because I don't see it further in the slideshow.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we do expect to be going into a lot more depth. The bill analysis, sectional analysis and that. This is just kind of the first blush. Here's the general concepts. Here's graphed out what this does. And the governor was looking at working with kind of a blend of structures that had found support and then tried to move it to a place where it's meaningful. As an example, brackets, where every jurisdiction in the world that I'm aware of that has progressivity uses brackets. Well, the Senate didn't seem particularly excited to deal with the brackets issue. We don't have to get to a meaningful place, you don't need to use brackets. So one of the first things we started out with was not using brackets and working on a way to get to what we thought was meaningful, a different direction.
Follow-up, Representative Kelsock.
On the, because I'll ask this question later on as well, but as we talk about meaningful, we've heard testimony to the effect that progressivity and brackets were necessary in any oil bill to be considered meaningful from other groups, not us. But so is that, does that differ in your opinion? And is there a way to get a meaningful bill, using your words, that doesn't include those provisions that will be acceptable?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes, we believe so. And as we kind of go through and you see how it graphs, what we've done is we've graphed this bill compared to current law, so you can see how it compares to current ACEs, as well as to the governor's HB 110, so you can see a comparison there from where we are from there. And you'll be able to see how it relates to both of those and in between both of those.
Okay. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Butcher, I was actually looking for some information earlier today and wasn't able to find it. And we're sort of starting out from a point here that the point of view is that ACES isn't working. And so I was actually trying to find information about how the ACES tax has been working. And I was trying to find information about an audit that may have been done on the ACES tax so we could take a look at those numbers. And I was wondering, have they completed an audit yet on the ACES taxes over that started about 5-6 years ago?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, it's taken the department many years to get through the 71 or 72 regulations we had to get through with ACES, as well as going through a comprehensive audit during the switch during PPT from a gross tax to a net tax. We are currently comprehensively auditing the first year of ACES, which we received in 2008. We feel like we're at the top of the mountain. We've come back down to the other side, and the audits will begin speeding up now that we have all the regulations in place and we've moved from a gross to a net. But we are still well within the statutory range of getting those done. That being said, The results of the audit, because they're very company-specific to the workings of the company, are confidential and are not things that we would be sharing publicly anyway and would not be playing a role in this debate. But that's where we stand today.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, why don't we continue on here?
No questions,
Chair. Is it quick?
Maybe. We'll see who the answer is.
Representative Gardner.
In terms of being within the time limits under the law right now, and I don't remember, House Bill 110 proposed to reduce those time limits. So had House Bill 110 passed and we were still within the, would we still be within the time limits? What are they now?
Through the Chair, Representative Gardner, yes, we would be. The limits are currently 6 years. We were proposing 4 years based on what our auditors thought was a reasonable time period. Every time there was a regulation written and implemented by the department, the companies had an opportunity to then go through and put in a new tax return based on the specific specifications of that regulation. Many of the regulations were small and didn't get that much action. Many of them were more major and resulted in companies coming back in and doing them. So even though it was for year 2007 that trued up in March 31st of 2008, in most, if not all, cases, we had revisions to the tax returns through 2008, 2009, and then the clock begins anew every time we get a new tax return in because it's new, we're having to start over. So in most cases, we haven't had it for that long a period of time. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, we would still be under the statutory limits.
Thank you. The question was short.
All right, please continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I could have Mr. Tangeman go through the spreadsheet for us, please.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Slide 5 is the income statement format from the last few pages of the Revenue Sources book. It should look fairly familiar. We've added some row numbers and column letters there just so I can quickly point to the changes. Before I get into it, a lot of the discussion so far has centered around all the knobs that are available to turn and the different methods that we could attack this problem with, all the regs that we've put in place, the audits that we're catching up on, and basically what the bill does, it makes one calculation change for existing fields, two calculation changes for new fields. And we found this to be a very important way to go because throwing out ACEs, starting over, recreating the wheel wasn't appealing to us as a state, certainly not appealing to our employees in the tax division. As you are well aware, the state often is unfairly taken to task for being undermanned, outgunned. The private sector can throw more money, more auditors, more resources at the tax situation to figure it out and get ahead of the game. Well, we've now been under the same tax structure for coming on 5 years, a few more years if you're going all the way back to when we switched from gross to net. So we found it was very important to work within the existing system. We as a state, our tax division, understands the current legislation, tax, as well, if not better, than the private industry. Repsol, this past interim, we spent a tremendous amount of time answering their questions, explaining the tax to Repsol. And that's just one example of a international company with lots of resources in their accounting department, but they were coming to us and we explained it to them. So we see ourselves as being on equal footing now. And throwing out the system and starting over certainly isn't appealing to us from the state perspective, so we thought it was important to stay within the existing structure. That being said, I'll show you exactly how this tax system, change to the tax system works. Column D and E are the ACES structure and the HB 3001 structure and how it calculates down through the income statement. I will point you to the first change and the only change under this legislation for existing production, and that is in cell E24. Everything up to that point, calculating the gross value point of production remains the same. Calculating the PTV, production tax value, remains the same. Nothing changes from ACES. When we get to the production tax value and the calculation that is in cells D and E, line 20, the calculation of the base tax is taken from that, and then the production tax percentage is calculated off of that. So if you notice in cell B23, we have the progressive tax rate calculated at 16.7. That's based on the full PTV value. The step that we're making in this bill, it appears in E24. And what this is, it's a 40% reduction to the gross value at the point of production, which is cell E12. So it's merely one calculation. We're taking 40% of that $17.4 billion. It's a reduction in cell E24. We take that from the $12 billion in cell E20, and we have a new adjusted production tax value in cell E25. Now, as I just mentioned a little bit ago, the progressive tax rate was already calculated on the full PTV. So this is where we apply the 16.7% to this new adjusted production tax value. So the first delta change that you'll see is on line 26, where in D26 you see the $2 billion calculator under ACES. Under this bill, the calculation amount is $900 million. Line 27 adds the base tax and the progressive tax rate, and the delta is shown on E28, a reduction of $1.1 billion. Line 30, we take into account about $300 million in additional tax credits available through the 40% lease expenditure credit, and you have your new estimated total tax after credits. So while that was a lot of verbiage to explain what's happening here, the only calculation change is taking place on line 24.
Questions from the committee? Representative Kalsop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The on line 24, the gross revenue exclusion, I'm trying to think of a way to put that in terms of something that people would understand. So would this be like, like say, a standard deduction on a 1040 form? Would that be an appropriate way to look at that? I mean, essentially what you're saying is the amount of tax that's payable to the state of Alaska is roughly $7 billion less under this, the total income of which you will derive the tax is $7 billion less versus column D, which is ACES.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I would simply describe it as the tax reduction is the $1.1 billion. The way it's calculated, you're probably correct that instead of taking the 16.7 progressive tax rate against $12.4 billion, we're taking it against $5.4 billion. So the amount that is being calculated against, yes, is a $7 billion less. Correct.
And then a follow-up. So where did this 40% come from? Well, how did it come out? And then to answer that question fully, how does it get us to the point where there's more production, more jobs, more oil in the pipe?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we worked with the governor's office, the governor, on working at different percentages, taking a look at where that lands with the effective tax rate, with absolute profit, with percentage of profit, running through the different models to come up with what we thought would land at a place that would be viewed as material, similar to HB 110, not as much of a cut, but similar to HB 110, and the decision was made to stop at 40%. And where that translates is, we believed that would be in the general vicinity of where companies would say, this is a material change, this will lead to more investment, this will lead to more production.
follow up. I mean, the debate about whether a change in the tax system will be meaningful for the companies, and you just use the word material, I guess then, did you find the $1.5 billion delta and then deduct it from the gross revenue exclusion, creating that $1.5 billion?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it was a matter of looking at the percentages and deciding not just through the what we're going to go through, which is the effective tax curve, as well as the absolute profit, as well as the percentage of profit. It was looking at all of those and coming up to a place where we thought it would be viewed materially, which means is it less of a cut than 110? Yes. Is it radically less? No, it's not. We thought if you were to get radically less, it would increase the likelihood that companies would look at it and say, we don't see this as a place that will change the way we view Alaska in terms of investment. And there's no perfect percent. There's no, 39% is yes, 40% is maybe, 41% is no. It's a general area that we're certainly willing to work with the companies on, but we felt comfortable coming out that this would be viewed as meaningful.
So, again, so Mr. Chairman, to follow up, so the term material was how much more money the companies will get back?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the term material or meaningful was a tax reduction and looking at a number of things, looking at what the tax rate would be, looking at what the dollar amount would be, looking at what the percentage change between the government and companies would be. It was looking at all of those things.
Representative Sutherland.
Thank you, through the chair, Commissioner. Before we get too much into the mean and so forth, I'd like to run through a couple of numbers again, if I could. Looking at the chart up there, I want to ask you, line 12E gives us $17 million. I just want to, actually below 17, could you run the calculations for me again? I think I don't know the formulas in the spreadsheet. So run what's happening with that $17 million. That times 40 gives you what number? Just run through it.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. So the 40% of the $17.4 billion is the exclusion amount, which is deducted from the $12.4 billion in line 20.
So that the number is that the 6.9?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so that's 12
point. That's the deduction amount, correct.
Okay.
To get to the 5.4, and that's what the 16% is applied against.
Okay.
For the progressive tax.
Mr. Chair, if I could, an easy way to think about it might be that 100% of the production is taxed at the 25% base rate. 60% of the reduction is taxed at whatever level of progressivity it is, and 40% is held harmless from that progressivity. That's kind of similar to what Representative Kawasaki was talking about as kind of a, what you'd be able to deduct out of it. So. Full taxes on the 25% and 60% on the progressive.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And one of the questions, I believe it was that the Senate was asking, and I'd like just the members of this committee to understand, and maybe I have it wrong, but as I understand it, one thing we could do is reduce the progressivity amount, and you discussed this, or we could just take a chunk of the profits out, 40% in this case, and keep progressivity the same on the balance, and we get to the same result. But doesn't this method add another little bit of complexity in trying to, for anybody, for us or for the industry, to understand our tax system? So does that make sense to add a step of complexity if the same result can be had more easily if you agree on the result you want?
We could just get better progressivity. That'd make it simple.
I said if we agreed on the result we wanted.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, this is a fairly minor tweak to us. You're correct, and we could do it different ways, and all of them would involve some number of regulations. But actually, when this rolled out in the Senate, this isn't of the different variations we were considering. This isn't something that we had looked at before. We looked at it. We talked to our folks about it. They said, this really is only, as Mr. Tangeman has said, a one more calculation in our spreadsheet. So we saw it as a fairly minimal tweak that could get us to potentially where we could all agree on.
And just to add one comment to that, the bulk of the complexity within the ACES structure is taking place above the line, so above the PTV value. And that's really what's taking us from the gross calculation to the net calculation. Net is where we get to PTV. Below that is where we're making the change, and that's merely a tax calculation change. So the bulk of the work that's taking place and what's deductible, what's operating, what's capital, et cetera, is remaining unchanged. So it has minimal to no effect on us internally and the private sector in trying to figure out the differences here. This is only affecting the tax calculation on the net amount, basically.
Thank you.
Representative Seed?
Thank you. On line 16, the deductible capital expenditures, is that the aggregate deductible expenditures that are estimated across the entire North Slope in all existing fields for 2013?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that number comes from the revenue sources book, page 104, which is our FY13 production tax estimate. And what that is allowable lease expenditure deductions. So, again, there are other expenditures that companies are making that are not deductible, and that is not reflected here. This is our estimate for what will be allowable lease expenditure deductions.
One thought?
And when we're, of course, we don't tax on the whole North Slope as a unit. So I guess my question is, in those companies that are not instituting that CapEx, have a very small CapEx in there, or those that have a very large, as we go forward, maybe you can also run some scenarios for those companies that are investing and those that are not investing, and how this how this is going to influence those different companies. I know you said you didn't want to have any tax change between the companies that are investing or not investing, but that's not some of our goals. So I would like that discrimination as you bring forward some other charts.
Sure. And through the chair, Representative Seaton, maybe I can explain myself a little bit better on that particular point. When the Senate bill came out, they switched to a kind of half net, half gross, and they were working on gross on the progressivity. And what that ended up doing was, if you had a high-cost field or you were trying to develop heavy oil or viscous or something that was going to cost a lot more, it penalized you because progressivity was off of gross. Whereas if you were spending very little, it kind of in harvest mode, it actually benefited you in getting that gross. And that's where we had companies come forward and say, we are developing a higher cost field, we're putting higher, we're spending more to get our oil out of the ground, and because progressivity is on gross and not on net, and we're not able to deduct our higher costs out of the equation, we're being penalized. This is actually going to be a tax increase. So what we were trying to do was not to penalize companies that had higher costs at the expense of companies that had lower costs.
Commissioner, just to clarify, though, the way this is in 3001, the way it's set up, the more you have in terms of operating expenditures, in other words, the more expensive it is to run your field, the more investments you make, the allowable capital expenditures are greater. The more money you invest and the higher cost your field is, the less you're going to have to pay as a percentage of your total revenue.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so there's advantages to making those investments under this plan versus the original deal, which, as you say, just taxed the gross.
That is correct. Having an all net similar to what current ACES is, instead of having the progressivity piece of it being strictly gross and not having companies able to deduct their expenses off of those taxes.
Okay, Representative Seaton, follow up
on this point. Yeah, I mean, we don't have that in front of us at all, and we haven't analyzed gross progressivity or anything else. So what I'm trying to figure out is the incentives that are built into this structure for those that are in harvest mode, or those that are in expansion mode, or those that are investing overseas, or those that are investing in Alaska. And I don't think that just removing 40% of the gross from the progressivity makes any discrimination among them at all. And so I want you to come back and show us how what the governor or what the administration has put forward as an issue is actually going to incentivize people to invest in Alaska instead of just reducing their taxes, and wherever they take their money, the effect is the same. And so that's, you know, I don't want to get into something that's not in this bill. I just want to know how this bill, your structure of it, incentivizes people to invest in Alaska differentially from taking that money to Russia.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Yeah, the way we listed this out, in fact, we put the same slide deck together since we were in both bodies in the same day, was to point out the pieces we took and the pieces we did not take. So that was more probably applicable to the meeting we had this morning than it is to you that didn't have that particular piece of legislation in front of you. But I understand what you're asking.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Deputy Commissioner, line 24, an interesting label, gross revenue exclusion. Why wasn't it just called adjusted gross revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, it could be we took the same language that the Senate Finance Committee was using, so they would understand that we were using the same structure they were using, but it could be called that.
Thank you.
Yeah, please continue, Commissioner.
Taking a look at slide six, this gives you a view of the effective production tax rates that would be paid. The black line is current law, ACES. The red line was HB 110, the governor's bill. And the blue line is the bill you have in front of you, House Bill 3001. So as you can see on the effective tax rates that would be paid, the bill in front of you is a substantial reduction from current law. It is an increase, a small increase, compared to HB 110 that you previously had in front of you. And you can tell that the differences between HB 110 and the current bill occur mostly between $90 to $160. With not as much of a difference at very low prices and very unseen in our time prices. That's why we believed as we worked on it, that looking at this particular slide, that it would be viewed as meaningful, because although it is a tax increase from HB 110, it's a couple hundred million dollars.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry, Commissioner, I got a chart with multiple lines on it. Is that different than the one you're presenting now? Looks like that's a...
Yeah, through the chair, we apologize. We'll get corrected copies. Apparently, you have some, whether you print from a PDF or a PowerPoint, you get a different output. But that's correct on the screen.
Okay, good. Makes much better.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. The one thing that puzzles me is that under ACES, where we have progressivity, which is in part meant to be an incentive for people to reinvest their profits here and not invest them elsewhere because it brings down the tax rate for every dollar. So when we look at a chart like this showing ACES, this only assumes that they don't take that step of reinvesting anything beyond the base 1536.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, this is showing, trying to take the best way you can really weigh what a company would be looking at in terms of tax rates in front of you and showing what it is they would be paying. So you're right, if a company were to reinvest a lot more, that would be of some benefit to them compared to not. But ultimately, when you're looking at the exceedingly high tax rates we have with ACES, that in and of itself is a deterrent to invest in Alaska.
Thank you.
Taking a look at slide seven, this is the marginal government take. And again, the marginal tax rate is the rate of, say, the next dollar of a barrel of oil. to see what that would do in terms of what a company would be paying. And this is frequently what you hear companies complain about ACEs, that it takes the high end away, because as we get to higher and higher prices of oil, we get to 80, 90% of each increasing dollar going to government. And the reason that is the progressivity and the increasingly high tax rate doesn't just apply to that particular piece or bracket, as it's easiest understood. And to give you an idea of, say, with your federal income taxes, when you from $0 to $15,000 in income, we all pay the same tax rate. From 15, and I don't know these specifically, this is just ballpark, from 15 to 22,000, we pay a little bit more. From 22,000 to 32,000, we pay a little bit more. But those higher tax rates are only taxed on that higher level that we're making. We're all paying the same lower levels. It just gets higher as you go. Every other jurisdiction in the world that has progressivity does it that way, and that's why we had brackets in the initial bill. The way Alaska does it is when you get up to a higher tax bracket, that tax goes back and the higher rate is paid on the entire barrel of oil. And that's why as you get up to the prices we've been at the last few years, $100, $110, $120, you're getting closer and closer to 100% of the income coming in going to government. And that's what companies have been complaining about, that they that lessens the reason for them to want to invest in Alaska with the, in the current high-price environment, because they see so little of the upside. And so you can see the black line as ACEs. You can see it's as progressivity kicks in. It moves up to kind of peaking at a little over 90% at 160, around 160, 9250 PTV. And then you see it drop when it goes from 0.4 to 0.1. In the red, you can see the brackets and the marginal is lessened because we're dealing with a bracketed approach. We're not dealing with the progressivity on the whole barrel. And in the blue, you can see the current bill in front of you, which has a line lower than ACEs, but working exactly the same as ACEs because we haven't changed the slope. We have simply kept it the same and changed where the trigger point's going to be.
Hey, Representative Seaton, then Senator.
Thank you. And just for clarification, you're talking about incentive to reinvest, and of course, the marginal, these high marginal tax rates means that if you reinvest, you lower the price, the production tax value, so you dramatically lower your taxes. By creating the bill the way you are dramatically lowering the marginal tax advantage of reinvesting in Alaska. And so I'm trying to figure out how eliminating the tax incentive to reinvest, what are you substituting for the tax advantage to reinvest versus anything else that discriminates between reinvesting in Alaska versus somewhere else?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's why the simplicity of the way we're approaching this is beneficial, because the incentive through the operating deductibility and the capital deductibility has not changed. The way you calculate down to PTV remains identical to the way it is to ACEs. So if you invest, you're still realizing those same benefits under ACEs. The only change is the amount of tax the company's going to pay below the line here. So they're realizing the same benefits by reinvesting. It's just that the amount of taxes that they're paying on that ultimate net PTV that's calculated is going down.
Hello, Representative.
Yeah, I guess the question is, sure, the tax credits, we're not changing that incentive, but the incentive of having taxing a barrel at whatever that price is as one unit means that as you reinvest in Alaska, you dramatically lower the production tax value on all of your oil. And by the calculation you've made here, eliminating 40% of the gross value of production, it means that the amount of tax incentive to reinvest is lowered by 40%. The tax value, you lower your progressivity much less than you do under current ACEs. And so you must be substituting some other tax incentive, but when you're eliminating this one, so I'm trying to, or dramatically lowering this one, I'm trying to figure out what other tax incentive you are substituting for the elimination of the tax incentive under this.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we're not substituting anything. This is still keeping a pretty aggressively high marginal take. We're still looking up in the 70s and creeping up to 80%. In talking to companies, they haven't said that they like the progressivity to be kept high because it gives them so much benefit. The progressivity is what the extremely high progressivity is what has been so difficult, I think, for them to deal with. And having looked back 5 years from the passage of ACEs, we aren't seeing any tremendous capital reinvestment like North Dakota, Texas, Alberta, virtually every place else is seeing. We're not seeing it. So I don't know whether the intent of ACEs was that this particular piece was going to work that way, but I think companies would tell you that, that's not the way it's been working.
Senator? Two quick ones. First on the left on the, I guess it's the y-axis, it's 100% of what? 100% of profit, 100% of the gross price of a barrel of oil? That's percentage of what?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that would be what percent of that additional dollar it would be taking. So if it says 90% at $130 a barrel, that means 90% of that dollar, 90 cents of that dollar would go to the government.
And second, and help me understand why the notch at $130 a barrel in both 3,000 and ACEs.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is because up until that point, every dollar, the tax increased by 0.4. And at that dollar amount, it then drops to a gradual 0.1. And that results in a lower marginal take per dollar because it's going up slower than it was at 0.4.
John Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, if we're keeping it at that every time it goes up, we go back to the start and charge that much. All right, now, if no other country or state does that, why are we keeping that in? I mean, there must be some... Can you explain that part to me? Because you made the comment that no one else is doing it, but we're doing it.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, when the governor's bill with brackets went over to the Senate, it was set aside, and among other things, we heard complaints about brackets. They didn't like brackets, even though their consultants, had talked just like we had that this is the way other jurisdictions do it. It was one of the, what we heard were one of the negatives of the bill. So when we began crafting this bill, one of the first things we wanted to do was not roll out HB 110A and say, okay, here you go, let's try this all over again. The governor wanted to take the Senate structure for the new field, saying, okay, he liked that. He thought we could move forward on this, and he wanted to apply the structure to the existing fields. And he said, can we get to a point where we believe it's a material change with this structure? So it was an effort to blend, to kind of make a hybrid of getting to where the governor said many times, it's not the means, it's the end. We can get there a number of different ways, as Representative Gardner talked about. We can change the slope. We can do a number of things. This is one way that we can get there. There is no ideal way. Is this the way we rolled out? No. But it's something that the Senate liked in structure, at least for new fields, and we thought we could work off that.
Follow?
So in other words, you're working on something that hopefully is passable.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yeah, and I think as you look at the effective tax rate and where the line is, you can see it still gets to where we think companies are going to come up and testify. This is where we see it taking us as a company. Like I said, we haven't spoken to any company since the bill came out, but we did talk to Aloga, and they did see this as a material change, which we expected because, frankly, we compared all of them as we worked on it, and we would have been surprised if the difference between 110 and where we've moved it was the magic line that made Alaska not attractive to invest.
All right. Please continue.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at slide 8, these next three slides compare absolute profit, meaning they compare what dollar amounts in billions we would see under ACES at different price levels, what we would see for comparison under HB 110, and then what we would see under this bill. So if you look at $120, which is about where we are today, you see that under current ACES, the government take, feds plus state, is about $12.3 billion, and the company take is $4.9. And if you move to the next slide and take a look at what HB 110 did, it moved the company take from 4.9 to 6.3, and it moved the government take from 12.3 to 11. So there is a substantial benefit to companies doing business in Alaska at that price. We're not taking the huge slice that we are under ACES. Then when you compare it to slide 10, which takes a look at House Bill 3001, you're going to see that company take, instead of the 6.3 we saw under HB 110, is down to $6 billion. So we've moved cash from them back to the government, and the government take is a combined $11.2 billion. So under current ACES, we'd receive $9.6 billion. Under this bill, at current prices, we'd receive $8 billion, which is still a substantial amount of money, but would also, we believe, put us in a situation of increasing investment and ultimate production in the state. Taking a look at the next slide, breaks down instead of by dollar amount, because that's a little more difficult to calculate in your head, what the percentages are. This shows the actual percentages at different dollar amounts under current law, under the governor's HB 110, and then under this bill, where you can see that at $120, government's taking about 71%, with companies taking 29%. Slide 12 shows that shift from 29 to 36% for companies and from 71 to 64% for government. And then HB 3001 then is a shift from 36 down to 35% for companies and an increasing percent from 44 up to 46% in particular for the state of Alaska. So it's a substantial reduction from ACES. It's a small increase from where we were at HB 110, which we believe is not as much of a reduction, but will still be viewed meaningful by companies. Taking a look at slide 14, Mr. Chairman, this maps out new fields. The previous were existing fields, and with new fields, once again, the black line is the current ACES law. The red line is where HB 110 went with new fields, and the blue line is HB 3001. As you can see, it's not as much of a tax reduction as HB 110, and not that far away, and this initially came from what was done in the Senate. And as you can see, it's a substantial reduction from current ACES, which gives no tax breaks for new fields. So we believe that this is, although not what we had presented in HB 110, will be substantive enough to see meaningful change and meaningful investment.
Representative.
Thank you. I'm a little confused about the post-tax, post-credits, and we have the well-lease expenditures now applying, and I don't, how much is that? Because I don't see anything here. I see us being above before we had, when we didn't have any well-lease expenditures, and now we're given a 40% well-lease expenditure, and it's showing nothing as far as the credit for those well-lease expenditures.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this factors in if we were to implement those well-lease expenditures. If you were to take the 40% out of this bill and map this, the line would be a little bit higher than it is right now, and we can certainly map that out for you.
Quick correction, actually. If we went from 40 back to the 20 that's currently in statute, you'd have the red line. So the 40% well lease credit is taking it from 20 to 40.
On the North Slope.
Correct.
So you're saying that the difference in the red line and the blue line in this case is the 20%? Is it a 20% tax credit on well lease expenditures on the North Slope, and that's the difference in the calculation here?
Could we get a brief at ease? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I had mentioned before, the blue line includes the well lease credits, as does the red line, because HB 110 had the 40% well lease credits. If we were to take that piece out of the bill and it were to go from 40% back to what the current law is, which is 20%, you would see that blue line up a little bit higher, a little bit less of a tax reduction compared to current law. But we can map that out for you, so you can see, if you want to see where that would go without it.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that if we could get that
absolutely
done to us in a future graph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've understood from the administration that approximately $14 billion in investment may happen if there is meaningful tax reform. I'm wondering if you know how much of that investment is in legacy fields versus fields outside of the legacy area.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, so far of what the governor has spoke of, $5 billion has come from companies that are working in the existing fields, although we anticipate it would be more than that. And $9 billion comes from new fields, although we also anticipate it would be higher than that, seeing as that's just an estimate from one company.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Taking a look, Mr. Chairman, at slide 15, once again, this is the marginal take, where the percentage would be of the each additional dollar increase in the price of oil. And this is very much like we saw with the existing fields, and that you're going to see a lower marginal take for the government than you see with ACES. It's going to be a little higher than HB 110 because we're not dealing with brackets, we're dealing with the more aggressive progressivity, but we still think it's a material change. And the next three slides, Mr. Chairman, show percentages, share of profit difference in new fields between ACES, between HB 110, and between HB 3001. Obviously, we can't show you dollar amount changes because these are all new fields, prospective, somewhere in the future. So we can look at the percentages of what companies would see the profits would be at each dollar amount, but ultimately, you know, we will only the future will tell us what those dollar amounts will end up being. But if you look at, once again, $120 a barrel, you're seeing that ACES is the same. There's not a break for new fields. So it's 71% to government, 29% to companies. HB 110 at, you know, like I said, you can look down the whole spread, but just focusing on 120 where we are today, 59% would go to government and 41% would go to companies. And under HB 3000, it shifts a little bit more towards government, where 61% goes to government and 39% goes to companies. But as you can see, it's a substantial benefit to companies that will do the exploration, do the investment and development in new fields that currently aren't seeing any exploration, investment, and production. So it's giving more of a benefit to a company that goes out and explores in areas that tend to be farther away from infrastructure and more expensive to produce.
John Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, Brian, to give us some perspective on what the future might hold, the revenue projections for, are there any scenarios when oil does actually reach $270 a barrel? What are we looking at the next 5-10 years?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's not the case. We expect it to be, and we've been more or less in line with most of the experts over the last years. We expect it to stay in kind of the $110 range. Some see it dropping below 100 into the $70 or $80 range. That's about the lowest I've seen predictions in the next few years. The highest, I think one of the major oil companies had predicted that we'd see $170 at some point in 2012, but I think that that's not the consensus. That's more of an outlier of an opinion. But the reason we put such a large spread on it is because when ACES was being looked at, even though there were a few discussions that were done at higher prices, 110, 120, it was mostly focused in at 50, at 60, at what the future appeared to be in 2006. As we've discovered, our future has turned out a little different, and it may still turn out to be different than we see today. But we just wanted everybody to at least be aware in this conversation of where everything laid out. So if we were talking about $170 in 3 years, it's at least something that we had probably not made our decisions on, but been aware of how it would, how our tax law would affect it moving forward.
So that's the same reason my Subaru speedometer goes up to 120. I can hope.
And just to add one other thing, especially in the absolute profit slides, that's showing a consistent price for an entire year. Even when we peaked at 140, that was for a brief time and it came back down. So these are showing for an entire year.
I said we only got to 74 before it started shaking real bad. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to put a little context in this, I mean, to say that ACES didn't include discussions of higher prices is absolutely incorrect. I sat in this very room and we had the high marginal tax rates and the gold plating analysis with Gaffney and Klein in this very room, and it was a discussion that went on for several meetings. And so I want to correct the record that we did not just talk about 50 or 60 and not talk about those other numbers, because we were definitely, those graphs were on the walls in this room. But is the small producer tax credit incorporated in here? I presume you're talking about, back one graph, we were talking about the new fields. And I wanted to find out, because essentially what you're talking about is non-legacy producers doing those new fields. At least that's been the discussion so far, all the new players that are on the North Slope. And, of course, is the small producer tax credit included in these figures?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't believe. No, they're not.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that as we go through these, I mean, ACES has a number of pieces, and there's a small producer tax credits that were specifically engaged to change some of the economics of smaller fields and new producers, and if we're not including those in our analysis, then we're going to be looking at a partial picture. So as we go forward, and as we go forward in the future on these fields, and I'm sure we'll be doing field by field and that kind of analysis of what are the economics of a new field, I just want to make sure that we include those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to something that Representative Munoz brought up a minute ago, and She said the expected new investment was going to be $14 billion by the producers. Over how long a period of time would that be?
Through the chairs, Representative Peterson, I don't have it in front of me. I think it's varied on what producer was talking between 3 years and 10 years, I think.
Follow up. And so I was going back to Chart 5, and at the bottom we're with this new bill, where the reduction is $1.46 billion per year, and if they're planning to invest $14 billion, say, over 10 years, that actually ends up being almost exactly the amount that our tax reduction would be. So the amount they'd be investing would be the amount that we would be lowering our taxes. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson. Yeah, adding moving the decimal does come to that exact amount, but that is just a coincidence. We believe that we're going to be seeing significantly more than $14 billion investment as a result of the passage of this bill. But you do bring up a good point, which is certainly it is the companies have to come forward and explain to you and then convince you that a change in taxes like this will make a material difference and let you know what will happen and what they will do and how they see the world moving forward. And that's going to be a major part of it. And they'll certainly discuss it in a lot more detail than I will, but having to talk through boardrooms and changing oil prices and all of the things that go into decision-making makes trying to come up with a number a little difficult. Even getting to $14 billion to me is a little bit of a surprise. But there are things that can be said. There are projects that can be discussed. There are a lot of ways that you can be convinced that there will be material changes as a result of this, and that's a piece of the entire discussion that we're having.
And just, I'd like to add one thing through the chair. If you look in C1, that's the barrels in FY13 that we're looking at, average barrels a day. So in 10 years, if you look at in our RSB, I believe page 39 or so, you show the decline over the next 10 years. And we show it as, we're now showing it as currently producing plus the underdevelopment under evaluation. And in 10 years, we're estimating that 47% of the total oil is going to have to be coming from new sources. So, again, if this entire exercise, what we're going through is to prevent that and to make sure that the investment required to bring on that 40%, 47% of the oil is realized. That's not a slam dunk. Just because we're saying in 10 years production is going to be at 450 or whatever, significant investment is going to be needed in order to realize that. And the fact that half of that oil is coming from new sources, that's what we're trying to incentivize, to make sure we get to at least that and hopefully more.
Thanks. On your slide 18 again, the new fields, share of profits from 2001. You had it there, just a slide 18.
18.
The state amount, the state take in there at those different amounts, how much of that is coming from production tax?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we would have to get you an exact breakdown of what's coming from production tax, what's coming from royalty, what's coming from corporate tax.
Well, an approximate, do you have any approximate amount of what percentage of that comes from?
We'd rather get back to you with the solid numbers, sir, instead of speculating.
Okay, and I'd like to follow up. And the reason is I requested a modeling of 3001 based on the April of 2011 analysis of a Great Bear type production field that showed that at $100 a barrel, we would have over 20 through 2028, we have a negative loss of production tax of $2 billion. And if we averaged, I think it was on that analysis, $80 a barrel. We have a negative $7 billion from production tax. And so I'm trying to figure out how, if we're looking at a negative $2 billion in production tax loss over the first 15 years of operation of that style of a field, how we can have that not calculated into this as far as share of revenue. And so I'd appreciate that. And I know that the Great Bear, you know, people are trying to say, well, they're not capable of drilling 200 wells a year or something. But, you know, we have a commercial proposal before us that was presented to the House, had numbers of wells, had production production amounts per year. And so I don't want to go in and say that that's not doable by someone else, especially when we have 6,000 wells a year being drilled in other shale operations in other places, and we're trying to somehow mimic that and then say, well, we're going to cut that down to 60 wells a year or something. So if you would get back to us on the analysis of that same thing that we did in just before we adjourned last year, I would appreciate that, and then roll that into how this works if these new fields are similar and are composed of shale oil.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we will take a look at that and work on it. You bring up an issue that I don't know how familiar all the members are, which is shale oil is a brand new world compared to what we're used to dealing with. And our structure has dealt with capital credits and using credits to get conventional oil. Well, shale oil is almost continual capital spending and drilling well after well after well, and 90% of all the oil out of a well comes in the first 2 years, and then it's just a stripper well. It drips out, and they move on to the next one, and it's radically different, not just tax-wise on what we've ever looked at before, but it's radically different in terms of development on what we've ever looked at before. We're looking at roads that would have to be put in, that would have to be driven, year-round, as opposed to ice roads that we're used to when we think about the North Slope. There'd be a tremendous amount of vehicles up there. There would have to be pads and wells and roads going on tremendously. And so it's a huge change for Alaska in terms of how we see oil development fitting into our tax structure, our permitting structure, and all of that. And as I'm sure most of you know, I know Representative Seaton knows, administration has a task force going on to deal with this between DEC and DNR and AOGCC and to try to come to grips with this, because trying to fit in shale oil to what we've gone in the past is very difficult. What DNR has told us is that shale oil is probably, unfortunately, but probably not nearly as close to us as we initially thought, and that companies probably aren't going to be able to drill nearly as many wells as quickly as they had discussed, but it is something that we're trying to get our arms around.
Okay, follow up?
And I just want to follow up, because we've had this for a year anyway, this proposal of people who spend millions of dollars buying leases. Great Bear did, and then we had Loyal, being up there bidding. ConocoPhillips has shale underneath it. We have people looking at buying into the Brooks Range operation, not for their conventional oil, but for their shale oil potential. So although you at Revenue may sit back and decide, well, maybe it's not real, if we're changing our tax structure, it's going to be in place and impact that. And if we have these kinds of negative billions of dollars over the, every year or over the life of the field, it seems like we need to know that when we're designing something for new fields and incentivizing new fields. Otherwise, we're digging ourselves possibly into a hole. So I'll appreciate that analysis, and we'll discuss it further.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we do take it very seriously. It's just early in the process. There hasn't been a well drilled yet. We don't know anything about the shale rocks yet. But you're right, it is coming, and we're optimistic about it. DNR also very optimistic about it.
Two more slides to go.
Okay, in summary, Mr. Chairman, taking a look at this, we believe the provisions in HB 3001 represent meaningful change. Certainly companies will come up and flesh that out far greater than we have, since we haven't had the time to have any of those discussions. We believe meaningful change is needed to incentivize development of Alaska's oil resources, to stimulate jobs and economic activity for Alaska's economy. Producers with our previous bill have committed to additional investment contingent on meaningful change. We believe this will get us there. Also, although we're excited about the work that's been done on new fields, and that's certainly something that we hope to have on the horizon 7 years or 10 years or 12 years out, to try to stem the decline in the short term, it has to come from existing fields. It has to come from where we know the majority of the oil is, to this point anyway, and that are in the current legacy fields. And so we believe the focus there is even more important. And we'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, yeah, the last bullet point, commitment to additional investment contingent. A two-part question is, of course, there are critics out there that believe there's a blind allegiance by this administration to people that produce oil. I don't think that's true, but as I've told the governor, I think status quo should be changed, but I didn't vote for 110, so somewhere in between. So can you provide to the two co-chairs this written commitment, if there is such a thing, from the producers to the governor, saying that there will be investment contingent on meaningful change?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I will provide to the committee whatever the governor has on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner?
My question was very similar. I'll just wait for the response.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. And Representative Herron stole a bit of my thunder there, but on the summary last bullet point, producers have committed to additional investment contingent on meaningful change, and that's very encouraging. But at some point, I know you've given us bits and pieces of this, but what is the form of the additional of the commitment? Have you just said that you're going to do more, or what is the actual form of this thing? And an additional investment, what is that? That for drilling, that's for exploring, that's for repainting the rigs, you know, what is it? And then contingent on meaningful change, I guess that depends on whether you're the administration or the producers or our constituents. And so if somewhere along the line, if you could kind of nail these things down, right now it's like trying to pick up a bar of soap in the shower, you know, on what these things mean. It sounds great, and I'm really in favor of that. And I did vote for HB 110, by the way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Land, the governor and I have both said the same thing from the very beginning, which is we can lay out what we see as the problem, we can lay out what we think is the solution, but ultimately companies are going to have to come forward and convince you and that this is what we're going to do, this is what the folks in the legacy fields are going to do with meaningful change, this is what companies are going to do, how they're going to look at Alaska differently. That's a very big piece of this. Government can't wrap it all up in a nice neat bow and tell you that. You ultimately have to hear from the industry, number one, that it's material, and number two, what that means and what that means for Alaska. And that's going to be a big piece of it.
Thank you very much. I go back to the Reagan admonition, you know, trust but verify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it was BP several years ago testified, and I can't remember which committee it was in, but we were talking about accelerating and trying to slow the decline and accelerate production. And at that time, they said that they really weren't interested in rapid acceleration because as they improved the technology for heavy oil, they were going to need that light oil as dilutant to be able to ship it down taps. Have they come to you and told you that they no longer have the philosophy of needing that light oil for dilutant when heavy oil, which is seen as the key for extended duration in taps and Alaska production, that they are abandoning that philosophy and that they are willing to rapidly accelerate and strip light oil out of the Prudhoe Bay area?
Through the chair, Representative Seat. No, the conversations we've had with BP, that is still a piece of it, and they're still working to determine what the mix would need to be, what percentage of light and what percentage of heavy they would need to get it down the pipe. And we also talked to them as we were drafting HB 110 about that and about potential incentives for heavy oil. And they said, we talked about it in the Senate Resources Committee earlier today, the committee there received the same information, which was they see it very promising on the horizon, but they're not at the point yet where they can even think through what the economics are to the point where we can give them some incentive. So it's conversations that we've had that if there's a role for the state in being able to tap with tens of billions of barrels of heavy oil and viscous oil in the North Slope in the Prudhoe Bay Park area, that we will work with them. But once again, long-winded way of answering last time we talked to them, they were still saying there needed to be some kind of a mix to get it down to Valdez.
Follow-up, Representative.
So, you know, and I'm very definitely willing to work with everyone on the North Slope to incentivize technology and help get there, and I think that the writing off, not having any ring fencing and writing off all those high costs against their existing production taxes is probably the best way we can possibly do that. But I guess what I'm hearing you say is that we could shove billions of dollars across the table, change the taxes, but the true incentive for accelerating infield drilling and stripping that oil out and shipping it down now before they have heavy oil is they're not going to do it, so that we're really just changing the tax structure, knowing that at least one of the big three oil companies has no intention of rapidly accelerating light oil production, moving it down the pipeline. I mean, they'll take the tax money, but they have other strategic reasons for not doing what we're trying to do with billions of dollars of tax money from the state being given away and not accomplishing the goal. And so I guess I'm really wanting you to give me, in the light of the discussion that you've had, that they said they're not interested in rapidly increasing the production and stripping the light oils out, what is the purpose, since it sounds like the delay in those rapid expansion and stripping of oil out of Prudhoe is based on needing that oil in the future for dilution of heavy oil instead of a tax-based result at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, there are billions of barrels of oil on the slope, and in conversations I've had with DNR or anybody else, I've never heard it couched that potentially there wouldn't be the light oil available on the slope, in particular if we get more investment and more development to be able to do that. I don't think it's a situation, certainly BP is better able to answer this question than I am, but I don't think it's a situation where BP would have to hold back on their light oil so it's there for heavy oil. I don't think that's one of the big issues here, in particular with the billions of barrels we know that are on the slope, that are in the fields, just not economic at this point.
And through the chair, just to add one additional thing, the point is to make Alaska more competitive to draw investment dollars. And those investment dollars are going to be used by companies in different manners. BP has a huge resource in heavy, so the investment will probably be going to heavy. And to put it in perspective, you know, shale oil
talk, you know, we talk like shale oil has been around forever. It just became economic a couple years ago. And from what we understand from the conversations we had, it was not economic until oil hit 60 or 70 barrels in dollars per barrel, which we've just realized recently also in the last few years. So you have to assume that heavy oil is going to need a higher price than $70 for it to be economic, and it's going to need the technology to catch up. And I think that's what North Dakota was able to realize. They saw a crossing of technology and prices intersecting at the perfect time. Bakken's been around for 30, 40 years. It's been known forever. And they've taken a couple runs at it, but it took $60 or $70 a barrel for it to be economic. And I think we'll see heavy oil and viscous oil requiring that same interaction. Technology, the investment to get to that technology, plus a sustained high price in order to make it economic.
One follow-up. Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm hearing is either we're not going to listen to the companies when they tell us that they need that light oil for diluting heavy oil as the technology advances, that we're going to change tax rates to try to force them to invest in stuff that they are going to and get rid of, send down the pipeline, when they're going to need that oil for dilution of heavy oil, that we're waiting for this mix of technology, which isn't here, and you've said it's not here. And I guess I just am really questioning if we are saying that we are going to incentivize and change the tax rates right now when the testimony to us has been that for strategic reasons they're not planning to rapidly accelerate and deplete those more easily accessible light oils. So I guess we'll wait and maybe you can come back to us with some other information on how that that we can force the companies when all three have to agree on accelerated production in those legacy fields, that that's going to take place when we have strategic and considerations that we're just saying don't exist apparently, and we're just proceeding on. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to just comment on one statement that was just made, and that's comparing North Dakota and the Bakken Shale. And really, you know, part of the reason why Bakken became economic, it was sustained $60 and $70 oil. There weren't any changes in the tax systems over there that happened during the times previous or leading up to it. What happened was completely a technological advance, and hydraulic fracturing, which is now a commonplace across the United States, found its way to North Dakota. I've been to North Dakota. It's cold, and it's a miserable place to be. On a second note,
I could go anywhere with that one.
It's on the summary page, and I, if we are going to hear more testimony in the future about the detailed changes that were in page 2 and 3 of the slideshow, then that's fine. But I just want to say that as far as meaningful goes, and it's in every single bullet, and I've heard it on every single ad that keeps running on repeat on local channels here in the city. I'm watching a lot of TV since we're stuck your afternoons sometimes. I still have a problem with what meaningful actually means. I think that we've heard the dictionary definition, which is, there's two. The first one is significant. And we've heard that meaningful means significant size changes and significant dollars back to the oil industry. That is okay. The second part of that definition, meaningful, is to have purpose and to be purposeful. And so if we are going to target an oil tax regime that changes the behaviors of these companies that I'd like to see so that there is more production, there is more development, there is more local hire, that we don't just see status quo maintenance that we've seen since the 80s when oil's been in decline, then that would be meaningful. That's the kind of meaning that I would like to see, and I hope that's the kind of meaning the administration demands from the companies that are leasing from the state of Alaska. So I guess, you know, this is just a briefing. It's our first hearing. We're going to have a lot more detail, but I want to know exactly what the governor means by the word meaningful. I want to know exactly how each of those specific bullets and each of the specific each of the specific bullet points in page 2 dealing with key provisions are going to get us to more oil, producer commitments, more development on the North Slope and the rest of the state, more local hire. I don't think I've seen it yet. I didn't see it with House Bill 110. I was not a big fan of it going through the first time. But we're here for 28 more days, and I hope to learn more about the bill.
Representative Sutter?
I appreciate the chance, through the chair, thanks for the chance to ask questions. This is the first time I've had you before us, and thanks to the co-chairs of resources for letting energy sit in on this. But kind of try to be the devil's advocate a second, kind of try the other guy's hat on and walk a mile. I've heard claims that there should be some kind of linkage between any modification of oil taxes and a commitment, a firm, bindable commitment to produce more oil. What mechanisms exist to accomplish that kind of linkage, and what's your thoughts on them?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, actually, you know, I've been told it's unconstitutional to try to attach some kind of quid pro quo to state tax policy. And we've talked a little bit before, and I think companies are going to talk a little bit about how difficult it is. I mean, to as an example, you're a company and you see promise in Alaska, and you want to say we'll invest X number of billions of dollars, and you mean it, and then the price of oil 2 years from now is $40 a barrel. Well, are you going to be held to your commitments by the state of Alaska? Or you have a massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and all of a sudden your company may just be fighting for its survival. And the only reason I'm bringing these up is these are all things that companies need to think about when they're talking, and I think that's what makes it hard to have a company come forward and say, well, this means $2 billion, and if you move the line here, it means $3 billion. That's an extremely difficult thing to expect to hear from companies. However, they do need to talk about what this does mean, what this is going to mean when they go into their company's boardroom, what potential they see, the legacy fields, what potential's there that they see being able to, with no promise written on a sheet of paper, you know, signed in blood, but they need to give more, you know, as much detail as they possibly can that we're taking this step. And it's good policy just by the mere fact, in my opinion, that we're sky-high tax-wise compared to all of the areas, you know, that are going crazy down in Lower 48, but that they also recognize and need to convince you that this is going to lead to something material.
And I'd just like to add one additional point. We're not looking at this in a vacuum as far as how will this affect Alaska. It's important to see what the numbers are and how it does affect us long-term and short-term, but you also need to look around and compare what has been happening around the world with our competitors. We're not going into this blind thinking that it's not happening elsewhere, but when you can look at what's happening in Alberta and North Dakota and Texas and all around the world. With prices these high, investment's taking place, and there's no debating that. Exxon, the article today, $500 billion in Russia. Haven't had a chance to look into it, but just the fact that they're talking those kind of numbers, the opportunity to invest is there with these prices where they're at, all-time highs. And that's what we're concentrating on, is getting some of that investment back to Alaska. So it's very, very important to look at the economics and see how it works within Alaska, within our tax structure, the effect it'll have on our coffers, but also we need to keep it in perspective that investment is taking place around the world, and we're not seeing the investment we need to see in order to turn the decline curve around while others are. So that's the macro picture.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I believe I understand that I'm sympathetic to the economic and competitive arguments in favor of this. What is the constitutional issue that's at play here?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know. We might have the Department of Law flesh it out a little bit, because we did talk about it when there were discussions. We need them to sign something, and I haven't dug into it enough. I took them at their word, but
for the record, some of my constituents do say it's a real simple quid pro quo. They give, you know, they give, we get, and I'd just like to be able to answer that question. So appreciate that.
Representative,
thank you. You're not saying that if we structure a tax rate that says that if you have production above the decline rate of the field, then we're somehow illegal or unconstitutionally changing the tax rate, and that's a quid pro quo. You know, you get the tax reduction if you produce above the decline curve, and I just want to clarify that that's not the style of tax quid pro quo that you're talking about being illegal.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you are correct. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about company X will do this if we do this. That kind of a contract is something that I don't think does, you know, whereas a country, you know, there are many countries out there that could do that. That's just not something, from my understanding, and if I'm wrong, you know, I apologize, then we'll check into it. But doing a company-specific, we'll do this to your taxes if you do this.
Any other questions from committee?
The issue of decoupling over the last couple of years has been raised. It seems that decoupling is more of an issue if there's a large sale of gas. With that looking to perhaps consummate over the next couple of years, is it appropriate to be looking at decoupling at this time, or is that something, did you consider that when you were putting the bill together?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the administration doesn't see decoupling as a serious issue at this point. We're hoping to get more information by the end of this year on potentially a big pipe moving forward, and the governor has said he hopes that the 2013 session is the gas fiscal session. And certainly both the companies and the state have said that there's needs to be changes in all likelihood to move the big pipe forward, and at that time that decoupling issue can be taken up. So as we discussed what to put in this, we didn't see it as a priority that needed to be dealt with.
And again, that's another benefit of working within the existing structure that we've all come to understand over the last few years. We can make a change. There are a lot of knobs. There's a lot of different ways to change the tax structure that's before us. And this is the one that we're presenting. When we're talking about gas, that's a whole different order of magnitude of the effect it's going to have on all of us, on all the resources. So for today, we can work within the structure that's before us and make the changes that we think are required without starting over.
Any other questions from the Representative Dick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand here. Of course, we all want to incentivize, you know, and raise production. But it seems to me there's two ways we can do that. One way is we can just drill more holes onto the existing finite amount of oil. And that seems to me that in the short run, that would, you know, raise production, but it would also hasten the end of the and of that. And the other way to incentivize, of course, would be to somehow enhance technological development, which we referred to earlier. And but it seems to me that if we try to incentivize, like, heavy oil, the technology doesn't exist. So it's a good concept, but it's not something to incentivize unless we were to directly put our money into research in heavy oil. And same way with tight oil and other oil. So it really seems to me that while I love the idea of incentivizing, but I'm saying incentivizing what? You know, hastening the end, or are we going to, talk about actually incentivizing? Then we should, maybe we should really put our focus on research. But one question I do have, and I wish somebody could help me here, is as I'm trying to visualize all of this, I need to understand about the migration of oil within a field. And if we just wait, and say we have 10 holes, and we can maybe hasten production by putting 20 holes in. But if we were patient, could those 10 holes actually drain that field? Would the migration come to that? I do need help in understanding that.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, we don't think we're anywhere near running out of oil anytime soon. And I think that we'll be presenting on that, and probably DNR will as well, about what the potential is on the North Slope. But DNR also can give you a lot more detail than I can. But I know that when production first began in Prudhoe and they punched a hole in, very high pressure. Over 90% of what came out of the ground was oil, with less than 10% being a combination of water and gas, natural gas. And those days aren't there anymore. They're cycling 8 billion cubic feet of gas to keep the pressure up. They're bringing, what they bring up now is over 90% water and gas and some sand and under 10% oil in a lot of those holes. So when it comes to the economics of the field, that factors in a lot to it, which is, okay, is it economic in this particular field from this particular well to bring that up and do the separating and everything else? And so it's much more expensive to produce a barrel of oil today out of Prudhoe Bay than it was when, you know, when it was the largest, when it was a massive reservoir, the largest in North America, and everything they punched down basically was just, you know, very, very high pressure oil.
And one additional comment, obviously AOGCC has a significant role in this because they monitor how to, what's the best way to extract the most oil out of a field. So they put limits on how to do that. So it's not a lot at once to the detriment of leaving too much in the ground. So I'll let them speak to that. I'm not an engineer, but USGS, you know, they say that we're 70% unexplored up there, I believe. And I'm reading Crude Dreams right now. I'm sure most of you have already read that. And it's a very interesting book that the way, you know, once Prudhoe was discovered, everybody went there. And now the way I see it is we need to incentivize to get them to get further away and start looking at that other 70% that's not explored. And I think that's if Prudhoe is it, and we all agree that Prudhoe is it, we'd be having a different discussion today. But everybody agrees that we still have a significant hydrocarbon base up there. And it might be heavy, it might be shale, it might be viscous, it might be 300 miles away from existing infrastructure. But nobody disagrees that we'd still have a significant hydrocarbon base up there. And that's why we need to continue the research and development and the investment going on so we can realize those and bring them in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You gentlemen, it's a complex issue. You've been marinating it for the last couple of years, and so I'm going to ask you your opinion. That's a question I'll ask everybody that comes in front of us. In your opinion, what fallacies or false arguments should we be on guard against going down as we address this issue for the next week or two or 3 weeks? And again, I'll ask that question to everyone who comes up here.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, for me, it's very easy to get bogged down into a lot of complexity. And when you start talking about tax rates, you know, it's easy to say, well, okay, it's not as simple as that. There's what's the cost, there's what's the world economics, there's what's the, you know, all of these other issues that all play into the economics on what's going to move forward. So I think the best thing is to try to be able to focus down on specifically what it is and weigh all of it, because people can pile a lot of things on top of it till by the end of it you're kind of shaking your head and thinking, well, so what role does taxes play? And I think you'll hear as people testify, it's a significant piece. It's not everything, but we do end up having to deal with the hurdle of extremely high cost development in the state of Alaska. So if you compare North Dakota and you compare Alaska, it's not apples to apples, because you can drive right up to the work you're doing in North Dakota. You can't do that here. So it makes it more difficult as you're kind of evaluating everything, and you just really do have to not only be aware of everything else that's being talked about, but not overweigh anything to such a degree that there's one thing that if one person says one thing, it solves the problem, because ultimately we try to look at it in a bigger picture, which is, and Mr. Tangeman and I spent a little bit of our summer, you know, going to delightful places like Edmonton and North Dakota and Texas in the summertime, to have these conversations, to see the work that was going on there and what was happening there. And it reminded me of Alaska during the pipeline days. It reminded me of they simply can't find enough work for the people there. And coming back, it just kind of reminded us all the more that even though there's a lot of different issues that you need to look at for this, we're not seeing what everybody else is seeing right now. And why?
And I think my the biggest fallacy that I see is we're hearing a lot of how do we get back to that number? If we make this change, how do we get that money back? And my perspective is, the question is, are we at the right number? If that's the assumption you're making, that how do we get back to that number, you're assuming that number is the correct number. The way I'm looking at it now is we were under a growth system for many, many, many years. We changed from gross to net in PPT. Good idea when you look at what the ELF was. I agree that a change needed to be made. 1 year later, another change was made. And when we went from PPT to ACES, I understand that was not an economic decision. There were other issues involved during that time frame. But where I really focus in at is looking at ACES is introduced and ACES is passed. And there's a billion-plus dollar difference between those two pieces of legislation that many months went into modeling of ACES as introduced with the best available information. We'd only been under a net tax system for a year. They had no clue the impact of going from gross to net in the state. And it's no fault of their own. They just didn't have the numbers to look at. So you did a lot of modeling. You did a lot of hypotheticals by very intelligent people, but you came to a number in ACES as introduced. Over the next couple of weeks during that debate, it was discussed, and then over several hours, days, it really ratcheted up to ACES as passed. So that's the number. So if you're saying, how do we get back to that number, you're assuming that's the correct number. Looking at it today, we can look back over 5 years of actual, what has happened over the last 5 years under this tax structure in Alaska, and what's happened around the world. And you can see that things are taking off at these high prices around the world, but they're not taking off here. Why? I believe that that discussion that led up to ACES as introduced was very meaningful, and a lot of work went into it, but when we got to the actual number that we're looking at now, the discussion of how do we get back to that number is a false discussion, I believe. I believe it needs to be something less than that, and that's the number that we're looking at now, is what is the sweet spot? What is the correct number to get back to or to get down to in order to realize that?
Okay, we've got time for one last question. Representative Kawasaki has withdrawn his question.
Great.
I don't mind jumping right in, huh?
Sure.
Representative Sweden.
Yeah, I guess I just want to get a little more definition on you're saying that we're not seeing what they're seeing around the world. Other than new technology opened new fields, existing fields, mature fields, I mean, it was explained by somebody that was supporting your bill that this, you know, maybe this would create a stampede. And I guess I want to know what your definition of a stampede is, because we've got more new players on the North Slope than we had existing players total. We have the most successful lease sale last year that we've ever had on the North Slope. We've got more people looking at conventional and non-conventional plays on the North Slope. Employment is up on the North Slope. Department of Labor statistics are its highest of all time. So what is your definition of a stampede or something where we have all these international companies and smaller companies coming here under the bill that you said isn't being effective, and we've got the lease sales and the money that's come in from those lease sales and the interest. So what is going to be the level of interest that do we need three new companies? I mean, we got 11 of them up there. You know, I mean, I don't understand why you're saying that we're not seeing investment on the North Slope. I mean, we've got one company up there that's got 10 to 13,000 barrels a day that they want to get into the pipeline by 2013. End of 2013, 2014, that's Brooks Range. They've already drilled the wells, the Mustang. They can't, facility access is a problem. They've come to the state asking for, you know, a loan and willing to pay 10% interest on the loan to build facility.
you know, those facilities would be built in Anchorage or Matsu or Fairbanks and trucked up there for processing facilities. And I don't see anybody coming forward and trying to authorize ADA to investigate making that loan. And that's 2 years sooner than we can get the 10,000 barrels a day from Point Thompson. So I guess I want to figure out if you're saying that we're not seeing the stampede interest in the North Slope. Five players have sale prospects. So what is it that you want to see that you aren't seeing now, other than the big three producers not investing at a higher rate, which may be, as we talked about earlier, a strategic decision that has nothing to do with the tax rate? And what is it you want to see? What is your marker? What is that?
Through the chair, Senator Seaton, Representative Seaton, when you look at employment as an example that peaked actually right before ACES passed because of the aging field and the corrosion issue and everything, you see employment for the most part has plateaued over the last 4 or 5 years. And then you go other places where it's exploded 100 times over, 10,000 more jobs in Texas. And you're seeing, because of the price of oil, these huge jumps where we're doing this. Well, this is better than this, but this isn't what other areas are seeing. If you look at the capital investment that's going into, which is high, we've got mature fields. But it's not climbing either. It's dipped a little bit, and now it's kind of plateauing. And the investment's going crazy everywhere else that we've looked. And now it's going to be happening in Russia, offshore Russia. And so when you see in kind of our new world of triple-figure oil and things being economic that weren't economic before, and you see what's going on everywhere else, and you see us here just doing this, I haven't used the word stampede, but for me, anything that got us moving up again, similar to what many of these areas, including Texas, where they've been producing oil 80 years longer than we have, they were on our exact decline curve until oil got high, and then they flattened it out. And this is pre-shale. Flattened it out and began turning it around. So we just continue with this slow decline. And like I said, happy with employment numbers that aren't dropping precipitously, or capital investment that's not dropping precipitously, is fine until you look around and see that's not what satisfies everybody else.
And just to address the new players on the North Slope, sir, we've been presenting to chambers of commerce and rotaries, and one of the first slides we have is, what is ACES? How does ACES work? Because you have one side, when we first took this job, it was ACES is the best thing ever, and the other side was saying ACES is the worst tax regime ever. There had to be a middle ground or something in between. And what it is the tax credits on the front end and the production tax on the back end. Now, we have a very generous suite of tax credits, which is drawing these new folks to the state. The problem is the people, the money that we're paying out in tax credits to fund their operation is coming from the taxpayers. And there's the disconnect. While the enthusiasm and the new players we're seeing is great, what's going to happen if and when they find something and they become a taxpayer? Now, right now, it's great when the state's covering up 50, 60, 70% of your costs. But if they're going to become a producer, it's a different discussion with them. Are they hoping to find something to flip and sell to somebody else? That somebody else is going to have to look at that opportunity when it's presented and say, under this tax regime, how does that opportunity compare to what I can do in North Dakota, Texas, Alberta, any place else around the world? So while we appreciate the enthusiasm and it is bringing explorers, we all have to realize that there's a definite disconnect between that side of ACES and the production tax side of ACES.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner. We'll obviously have plenty of time to continue these discussions. We meet again tomorrow at 10 a.m. and then again at after lunch at 2 p.m. And yes?
Ask the commissioner for information to bring tomorrow to all of us.
Is it for the whole committee? Or
yes, for the whole committee. Because you talked about Texas being on a decline curve until prices got high and then it flattened out. Can you just let us know not in a great deal of detail, but whether they new oil that they have, is that their legacy fields that are producing more with high oil prices, or as we're talking about all new fields?
I can answer that right now. To the chair, Representative Gardner, it is a mix. They've been able to go back to old legacy fields and revive them, because getting those last 40% of barrels or whatever that wasn't economic at lower prices is now economic. And there's also quite a bit of new activity going on in areas of South Texas and West Texas that hadn't previously been explored.
Okay, thank you. Tomorrow I'll be getting into kind of the problem that the state is facing in terms of all this the oil issue and the oil tax issue. PFC Energy will give a presentation more or less talking about the business of oil and how the investment decisions are made. DNR will be in here to talk about some of the technologies that we have available to help move the production curve. Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, thank you for coming by. Glad we could have a dignified discussion and get through all 20 slides in 2 hours. All right, with that, everybody will be here at 10 o'clock tomorrow.